You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
This is Nalini Kodamraju. She is visiting us from the University of Twente in the Netherlands, where she is in the Department of Communications. And she is also visiting at MSR for the summer. And she's going to talk today about a project she's been doing for a while, the title of which is The Tension Between User-Centered Design and E-Government Services. I should note that Nalini has worked on a whole variety of different things over the time that I have known her, first when she was a sociology grad student at Berkeley, and up till now. So the other thing is she's starting to do a lot of research on online dating sites and different kinds of practices around the globe. That if you're interested in that, you should also talk to her about this. And at this point, I'll just go for it.
Lovely. Thank you very much for having me. As Dana said, I'm trained as a sociologist and found my home in a communication department, where most recently I've been working on e-government. Part of why this topic is interesting to me, I must confess right away, not really because I was particularly interested in e-government, but I was interested in design. So I spent a fair amount of time doing usability and user research work in a corporate kind of setting. While I was in sociology in grad school, got the chance to really think about how design and sort of deeper social questions and structures may intersect. And this project on e-government is one sort of output of that kind of thinking. I've prepared sort of a 25 to 30 minute talk. I'm pretty informal, so if you would like to ask me something straight off the bat rather than waiting till the end, please do. I'm happy to be interrupted. So this presentation is about e-government services, it's about user-centered design, and it's about the challenge of doing user-centered design in e-government settings. It's based on research that I've done with a colleague, Thea van der Heest, in the Netherlands, and it's part of a larger e-government project that's been going on in the Netherlands in general. It's also based on an article, which is currently under revision for publication, has been accepted. And I mention that because I'm still at a point where I'd be really interested in hearing feedback. So if people have comments or thoughts or additional references that they think might be useful, I'd love to hear them. So I'm going to start with some definitional things. E-government, what's e-government? E-government is basically the use of digital technologies, the web, email, SMS, text, to provide government information or citizens, or services to citizens, or to facilitate communication, some kind of communication between governments and their constituencies. Kind of a broad definition. I should stress that often people think when we're talking about e-government that that's something that's only happening in rich Western countries. Actually, e-government initiatives are happening worldwide in a wide range of nations, so to sort of keep that in mind as I go through this. What do I mean then by user-centered design? The sort of broad definition here is it's a structured approach to producing interactive systems, usually software or websites, by involving users or potential users and addressing their needs throughout the entire design and development process. Sometimes when I present about user-centered design to an audience that's never heard about it, I get a little bit of this duh, well, isn't that really obvious? But in context, what tends to happen is often, historically, when things were being developed, software or websites, the needs of the users weren't always put first. Often the needs of the system, the needs of the stakeholder building the system tended to be the thing that would come first, and the users were often an afterthought. And so user-centered design is part of a larger, let's call it a movement of the last 20, 25 years, depending on how you measure it, to make sure that users' needs were put at the center of the kind of development process. Some methods that tend to happen in user-centered design, and again, this is just sort of the background. Straightforward interviews, you actually interview people about what their needs are to determine what the system should do. some mixture of either task analysis or ethnography or contextual design, basically observing the user. So rather than asking them directly, watching what they do, watching how they open a bank account or how they attempt to set the time on their VCR, if they still have one. Participatory design, particularly common in Scandinavia and some of the Northern European countries, where users are a very active part of design. They may actually suggest designs, work on concrete prototypes. And then usability evaluations, usability testing, also known, where you're evaluating rough drafts or prototypes in an iterative sort of process. You see what works, what doesn't, and then you make recommendations. Hopefully it gets improved and the cycle begins again. So that's a little bit the context of e-government and user-centered design. This is the official standard. I always like to, I would bet the vast majority of people who actually work in user-centered design have never seen this standard. But, and I'm not saying they should necessarily, but I always like to put this standard up to give an idea of the thinking behind sort of human-centered design process and the degree to which it's iterative. You start with identifying a need for a human-centered design. You start understanding the context. You specify requirements, both from the viewpoint of the user and of the organization or the stakeholder. You produce a solution, you evaluate, you assess, and then you start the cycle again. So this is sort of the international standard on it. Now that I've defined the terms and we all are clear what we're talking about, I'm going to talk a little bit about the research context. So as I mentioned, e-government projects are taking place throughout the world. What seems to be a constant is that users seem to remain a challenge for e-government. In the European setting, only about 50% of European businesses and citizens actually use e-government, and those users are only moderately satisfied with them. So Capgemini did a large-scale study comparative last year. What's relevant about this is that e-government is not new, so governments, particularly in the EU, have been pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into e-government projects for at least 10 years. So it's not a matter of this just came around and now they're actually implementing e-government projects, but actually it's been in place for quite a long time. And there's been a fair amount of assessment of why this might be. Why is this a problem? Why aren't users using e-government to do things from file your taxes, to apply for permits, to renew your driver's license, all these kinds of things. Some of the obvious suspects for why people don't adopt technologies are there, infighting between government agencies, poorly allocated resources. But what also comes up again and again is that the technologies themselves, the e-government services or products or systems, are not user-centered. Even when governments are committed to making them user-centered, they turn out not to be. So the rhetoric is right, sometimes the resources are right, the project begins well, and the product you get at the end, the sort of solution, fares poorly in terms of satisfaction. So my colleague and I sort of were examining this problem in the context of the Netherlands, and one of the things that we sort of noticed in the literature was that this lack of user centricity could be responsible for the slow uptake of e-government, and that's actually an important problem. As you can see, there's no point building all of these services and targeted to your entire population if people are not going to use them. And in order to figure out why they're not going to get used and to improve the numbers, focusing on the user seemed to be important. So our sort of analysis, it's sort of the takeaway of the talk, is that there's a fundamental tension between the needs of users and the needs of government, and that makes it difficult for governments to center e-government around users. This will be a little clearer, I think, after I give some concrete examples, and we also argue that this is different than the kind of challenge that for-profit companies face when they're trying to implement user-centered design in what they build. A little bit about the case study that we used, PortNL in the Netherlands. The Netherlands, for those of you who don't know, is actually incredibly what they call e-government ready. So one way that the UN has sort of dealt with how to assess all of the governments doing e-government projects is they've come up with this e-government readiness index. It's a quantitative composite index. It measures things like telecommunication infrastructure, a website assessment that might look like, is it that you can just download the form in a PDF, or can you actually fill in the form and submit it online? And how much human resources do you have in place to actually deal with whatever the particular service is? So the Netherlands fares pretty well, especially for a country that size, in terms of being ready for e-government. And I stress that because this case study is not one of a nation that was poorly equipped, that didn't have the wherewithal, that had a population that wasn't online and wasn't engaged in technology. This is actually a case study of a country that's really well prepared for this kind of initiative. This is an example of an e-government initiative. It's not the one we designed, but it's just to give you a little bit of a flavor. This is the attempt of the Netherlands government to provide an identification number that's issued to all citizens within the Netherlands. You can see Ik ben een burger is I'm a citizen, the middle one is I'm a business, and the last one is I'm a government worker. And basically, this is sort of a gateway with which you can log into a wide variety of government agencies and do everything from renew your driver's license, to file your taxes, to register with the local city council, with the gemeente where you're living. So the project that we focused on, Portanel, was a portal. And it was a portal set up for expats. What we found in our user research is actually they don't like to be called expats. But so we call them people who relocate, usually temporarily, to the Netherlands to live and work.
And the acronym that?
Without an acronym, unfortunately. The idea was that expat really sort of conjured up these idea of colonial sort of overlays of I've moved with my hats and mosquito net to a hot country. So the idea behind Portanel is that it would be an integrated, personalized service delivery, one-stop government. What you had when you did an audit of what it took to move to the Netherlands, whether from the EU, another EU country, or from elsewhere, was that it was a process that was incredibly complex and involved interacting with, I think the least number was 8 different government agencies. By the time you went through immigration, registered where you were living, got work permits, it was a lot of talking to a lot of different people. So the Netherlands government decided this would be an excellent place to start honing and see that we can streamline the process a little bit. It was also a sort of novel initiative in the sense that it tried to integrate not only government agencies, but some of the other institutions that normally take part in this kind of relocation. So for example, getting a bank account and finding a place to live, registering with housing agencies. So it's an attempt to be a little integrative. What was our involvement? So my colleague and I functioned basically as user-centered design experts on the project and as user researchers. By this, I mean we sat in on all of the development meetings with both the designers and the developers. Gave feedback, listened, tried to do the sort of represent the user kind of work that classic user-centered design asks you to do. In terms of concrete projects, we conducted a pre-design study, which was basically long interviews that asked people from the moment that you thought about moving to the Netherlands to the point to which I'm speaking to you, tell me everything you did to make it happen, to get a sense of what the official paperwork, what the unofficial paperwork was, where the problems were. So sort of classic pre-design user research. Out of that came a lot of concrete objects that helped in the design, a sort of user requirements document, some workflows, so what did processes look like, what processes did people go through, those kinds of things. We designed a paper prototype, and then we did sort of a user acceptance slash usability study of the paper prototype of the portal as well. So that's sort of the, let's say, the data and our involvement in the process. This is a copy of the prototype, and the only reason, to be honest, I put it in the slides, I'm never going to refer to it again, but somehow when I give this presentation, if people don't see the prototype, they feel like somehow, I don't know, maybe there wasn't a prototype. So I'm really putting it in here just to give you a sense of this was the paper prototype, it was a portal, you're entering into the Netherlands, you could do a whole bunch of things on the site. I'm going to turn to the analysis. Are there any sort of questions at this point? Just thought I'd check in and see if... Okay.
You interviewed government people as well as end users.
We did. Yeah. So what was interesting about this the question... I don't know if they hear me. The question was whether we interviewed government workers as well as... Yes, so we did do more informant kind of interviews with different government employees at different sort of levels to see what their needs for the system were and how they experienced it. And what was very nice about the project is that they were actually involved. So it wasn't a setting where you had a design firm just coming in and trying to design this, but the government agencies were actually present at the meetings and represented as well as a way to contribute to the effort.
Can I ask under that, did you purposely select a range of users that would have had a range of experiences? So was that part of the mix?
We did, yeah. So the question was, did we select a group of users that would have a different sort of experience, like try for breadth in our audience? And we did. So what that meant is people coming with jobs, people coming as partners without jobs. Country of origin matters a lot, as one might imagine. Circumstances, whether you're coming as a student, whether you're coming as someone relocating with a big multinational, whether you're coming on your own to join a small initiative, a couple of people who had come legally but were coming for non-high-skilled positions, so like let's say working in a factory. So sort of a range across all the traditional socioeconomic variables. So now I'm going to talk a little bit, a little more about this tension that I mentioned between user-centered design and e-government. So we identified sort of four areas of tension. And I should clarify, by tension, I don't mean that people started screaming at each other in these meetings. I mean that you could see the sort of ideological and practical design decisions that were being made and how this reflected tensions that were existing. One of the things I think that's most interesting about the analysis is that they were often unrecognized or sort of in this sort of field of tacit knowledge where people sort of knew it was going and happening, but because they were sometimes talking about technical issues, they could pretend that they weren't really talking about social issues. And, you know, as sort of scholars who think about technology and society, you know, we're really aware that design renders visible all of these kind of social interactions, and that was an important thing to see. So the first one, what I'm calling government's tidy story versus reality's messy experience. Oh, yeah, sorry.
The last thing you said, you mentioned social interactions. Are you expecting interactions between different users of the site?
Okay. So the question was about social, at the end when I was talking about what design renders visible, whether the site was structured in such a way that I was expecting interactions between users.
Right, is that what you meant by social interactions?
Or by social, I just meant interactions between people. So it could either be I'm applying for something and getting a response from the agency, either automated or not. And the site did actually look also at sort of users, interaction between users, so sort of a chat room kind of function. Yeah, so thinking of social really in the sort of people interaction part.
I mean, I assume that most people, when they think of interacting with government, think they're not interacting with a person. They're interacting with a faceless bureaucratic entity.
You'd be surprised how much variety there is. So, for example, if you look at the websites for local level in the Netherlands, of which there are quite a few, and there's quite a few interaction, it's really somebody down at the gemeente office who's answering your email. So I mean, part of it might be a scale issue, but I think there's quite a bit of variability between nations and citizens' perceptions of with whom they're dealing when you say government. So contradictory visions of the task. One of the things you find in these sort of pre-design interviews is that, particularly when you're building a sort of more commercial product, is that you are supposed to go in and figure out what the user really needs, and then try and design something that maps onto those needs as much as possible. That's sort of a tenet of the user-centered design process. In the case of government, what you often had is they would say, well, we really need someone to relocate, and even more difficult, each agency needs something different, right? So the people concerned with work permits need someone to get a work permit. The people concerned with residence permits in the government were concerned about that. So we think of government big G, but actually the government agencies themselves are quite splintered and differentiated, and rightly in some senses, only concerned about getting their particular part of the puzzle fixed. So the next slide I'm going to show you is an example of what a user's experience was. So it's not important that you can actually read everything on the slide. That's not the point. What we did is we asked someone, and this was someone in a somewhat privileged situation. So American wife, husband had relocated to the Netherlands for a job. She had a small child, was not currently employed. It was their second relocation, so she'd already worked in Denmark, so she was not unfamiliar with what it was like to move. Advanced degrees, well-suited, well-resourced. The thing I point out most about this diagram, and basically we asked her from the moment that you thought about moving, tell me what you did. The things that are most interesting in this process are that everywhere that you see that shaded gray is a problem. It's where something didn't go as it should have. So her workflow, her experience of this process was that there was problem after problem, I'll come in second, problem after problem that needed to be fixed and needed to be addressed. Sometimes it was a straightforward equivalent of I sent in the form and I didn't get it back. Sometimes it was a more complicated, we shipped all of our stuff from the south of the US, it's arrived in Rotterdam. According to customs, we're not allowed to pick it up until we have proof that we're resident in the form of a lease, a rental lease. You can't have a rental lease until you have a bank account. You can't have a bank account in the Netherlands until you have a formal place to live. A lot of chicken and egg kind of problems, a lot of circular, there were a lot of metaphors about circles and vicious circles in this. This is how the user experiences the relocation process. And every person we did had a version of this. In the sort of attempt to reconcile and to do e-government well, it takes an awful lot of coordination between agencies and between non-government agencies, such as the banks, for example, to streamline this into something that could actually be designed for in a much more efficient way that you would see in a sort of user-centered design project in general. Sorry, let me return your question.
I think it's answered. I just want to be sure. This was not the view of the tasks using your tools. This was their view of their
overall experience. This is everything they did just out of the gate. Okay, so messy is sort of the bottom line of that one. Second one, governments must design for exceptions and not just the mainstream. Okay, so why this is interesting. An oft-heard maxim in user-centered design is do not design for exceptions. Designing for exceptions is inefficient, not cost-effective, problematic. If you're going to sell a product, design for the product that everyone's going to buy. Don't design for that one kook somewhere who's going to buy something once every 10 years. Governments, on the contrary to most commercial institutions, can't really follow this rule. They're obligated to design for exceptions. So what does this mean? First, this means they have to provide a vast amount of complete information and services. So if 80% of people are covered by a particular law around what kind of business you run, there is a small percentage who are not covered by that. But you still have to include that information, hopefully in an easy-to-find kind of setting, notwithstanding easy-to-read, understandable setting, somewhere on the website. And when you add legacy sort of issues, so you know what happens if in 1943 somebody emigrated under this particular rule, you can see that this gets very complicated very quickly, and things can't just drop off the site. In a way that in other sort of design instances you can actually do. It has to provide it to the entire population, which is diverse in many aspects. So this means depending on your government and your country, languages, it means traditional sort of accessibility to people who are sort of either visually impaired or hearing impaired or all the sort of other kinds of issues. And then the last one, it requires compliance through cumbersome processes that often run counter to user centricity. So what that means is that often if the actual legal setting or the formal setting that someone has to go through is complex, the site, the e-service, the system is often in a position where they actually have to demand compliance, where they actually want to know that you have completed these particular steps. And those kinds of demands often run counter to user-centric models where, in the end, you just want your work visa. And you want to do everything to streamline it that way, and you don't actually want to be concerned with the whole sort of complicated government decisions, legacies, et cetera, behind it. I used this slide as an example when I presented this to the Dutch, no longer the INS here, the Department of Citizenship and Information Services here, the equivalent in the Netherlands, who deals with people coming. So this is actually taken, the left is, do I need a visa? That's what users want to know. And the right is actually taken from the pull-down menu of the immigration site. You see that, you know, contrary to any sort of information design principle, these things are not comparable, this kind of list. And the reason I put it up here, it's because it reflects very clearly what the government sees as its relevant categories for whether you need a visa. We used to joke in our meetings that there's an example of an old legislation in the Netherlands that's still on the books, that if you are a circus artist, you actually have a different set of requirements. So we then called it like the circus artist problem, where you know, the Netherlands does not get a disproportionate amount of circus artists compared to other countries, but there was still this legislation on the books, and that needed to be addressed when somebody applied for a visa. So it gives you an idea of the sort of complexity that you're dealing with when you're dealing with designing a government service. The third one is designing for workarounds and breaking the law. So one of the things that's very obvious to anyone who's interviewed people in a government kind of context is people find workarounds, and they're not always legal, to accomplish their own goals. And by workaround, I'm actually using the more sort of technically informed idea of a workaround, where you're using computing in ways for which it wasn't designed, or avoiding its use, or relying on alternative kind of means. Some concrete examples. A British man moved to the Netherlands to work for a design firm, fell in love with this nice Dutch girl, didn't quite get around to getting a Dutch bank number, a Dutch identification number with a government service. He convinced his employers to deposit his bank account, his check, into his girlfriend's, who was Dutch, bank account, and just survived like that for a year. He made it work because it just seemed sort of a pain to go through the government process of actually getting that permission. Another example, in order to, I mentioned that you need to have proof of residency in order to get many sort of services in the Netherlands. Somebody at a company had a problem proving she wasn't on the lease. So she went down to the main office of the city council and basically burst into tears, and someone behind the counter just called HR at her institution and verified that she was an employee, and that was sort of good enough. Workarounds, they work. One of the interesting things actually about having government people in our meetings is that they actually work quite often, right? Mm-hmm. The government employees would tell all these sort of examples of people would skirt around the rules. That's how a lot of societies work, from, you know, depending on the society. You can't design for that. I mean, there's no way to say, don't bother getting your bank account, see if you can find a Dutch person who's legal and deposit your money into their account. It might be what people do in practice, but you can't design for that. And so it created some sort of conflicts. Another sort of strong example of that was another sort of EU example, in a certain city, you needed a license to operate like a vending cart, like a hot dog style kind of cart. They did some survey, and 80% of the people operating these carts had no license, right? And nothing happened. But if you wanted to start this business, the government had to tell you to go ahead and get this license and go through this cumbersome process and pay your money. Even though in practice it didn't happen, and in terms of getting to the point of being able to have your licensed cart, you might not have needed to do it, the government can't say that. So those are sort of examples of how the government, you know, who's tasked with upholding and drafting rules and regulations, can't actually design for workarounds. And then the fourth one is this, what we call the sort of conflicting desire for relationships, both around identification and authentication. So in e-government services in general, governments sort of expect and often demand that users who want certain services identify themselves, that they're individually identifiable, that we know enough about you to know whether you paid your taxes last year before we issue the permit for something else. You can imagine that this varies depending on the type of government and the type of service being requested. In the most well-intentioned e-government projects, the governments actually want to build sort of long-term relationships with its citizens and inhabitants and do things like automatically populate your address information in your tax form, you know, show some sort of interoperability, for you know, want of a better word, between the different government kind of agencies. Users, however, particularly when in this information-seeking mode, don't want any part of that. Bless you. They want to remain semi-anonymous, they want partially personalized information, and they don't want to leave a trace. You want to give, for example, the website at the tax authority enough information that they know your circumstance, but not enough that they might detect that you're actually trying to find a way around complying with something. It's a tension between wanting a long, permanent, longitudinal relationship and something that's a little more fleeting. That's sort of an information-seeking, quick in and out. And that's not just a problem for government, and certainly we see this kind of problem with users of all sorts of technologies where there's potentially identifiable information. But it becomes a difficulty very concretely in these kind of projects. I mean, I've yet to see the e-government project that does not have a debate about at what point should the user log in, at what point the citizen log in. How much information can we give them? Endless sort of like, well, we can use cookies and track their location by their IP address and then give them information that's country specific. I mean, you can see how these sort of debates could go about a technical solution when actually the real problem is that both governments and often citizens or prospective citizens or visitors are envisioning different kinds of relationships, and how do you design actually for that? It's just sort of a summary of the findings. We did sort of a lessons learned out of this. Some of them, you know, they vary in sort of obviousness. The first is just to accept the tension. One of the things that was startling in most of the e-government, this project, and most of the e-government projects I've sort of sat in on, is that no one actually talks about a tension between governments and users. There is a pretense that the government is in service completely to the user, and there's sort of an ignorance or willful ignorance that, you know, governments, even the most democratic, have coercive aspects. They need to get you to do things. That did not come up easily in design, particularly in design discussions that are all sort of about recognizing the user's needs. So I think just even putting that on the table in sort of user-centered design and e-government contexts would be a start. The second would be to deepen and extend the understanding of the relationship between people and governments. What I mean by part of this is that a lot of the user-centered design work is designed for one-off interactions, sometimes repeated, but you're going to Amazon to buy a product, and you might buy a different type of product, but you're there to buy a product. And yes, we'd like to know what you bought before, but the act in which you're engaging, the service you're getting, is the same. Government relationships span a really long time. You may have, around certain life events, which is often a popular way to think about this, for example, a child is born, you have to do a flurry of government activities, and then you don't deal with the government in any sort of proactive way for decades, perhaps. An approach to thinking about e-government that's a little more longitudinal would be useful, rather than thinking about it as a one-off kind of service that sometimes gets repeated. The third, which many people have written about, is about addressing the differences between commercial and government design contexts. We were pretty hardline about this in our work, that the government is not selling products. That's just not what it's doing. It might be encouraging adoption, it might be doing something that looks like selling products, but it's actually not. The more that these projects think about what they're doing in a more complex way involving sort of the state and citizen and rights and surveillance and all these sort of complex kind of social issues, the better off it's going to be, rather than thinking of my marketing my government service to my consumer citizens. There's a limit. And the last is about preparing for a re-engineering of government processes. One of the nice things about having government people at the table is that you could actually, once you go through a user-centered design process, you can actually start working towards improved government services. And I know that sounds really flippant and easy to say, let's just fix this government process. But in the right instance, it can work. So one concrete example that came out of this is that when I mentioned that you had to apply for like an official ID, the DigiID, where you could be a citizen or a government employee or a business, there was no way to apply for one if you weren't already resident in the Netherlands, which caused all these problems. You're thinking about moving, you want to apply for something. And one of the outcomes of this sort of research, where we emphasize the degree to which this was a problem, is that they're now instituting a sort of visitor identification number or prospective resident identification number, where, you know, once they heard all of our horror stories about the workarounds people use, that was one small way in which they could actually address the problem. But you also need, as government institutions who are differently motivated than for-profit institutions, to be able to hear those kinds of suggestions and then to be willing to incorporate them, which of course is often a much more complex task than I'm making it out to be. I have some final thoughts, which I put in the random kind of category, but they sometimes come up and people sometimes like to think about them. There's a variety of governments. I think early on in e-government, there was this utopian idea that if you threw up some e-government services in less democratic countries, somehow you would be engaging participation of the people. Guess what? E-government services tend to reflect the governments who built them. You have actually a wide range of government services that provide different things with more or less wiggle room, with more or less tracking. But it's interesting to think, as sort of e-government continues to develop in various countries, about what the services there are going to look like. The second one is user-centered design in and of itself is shifting a little bit. As technology spreads and the process, the approach is becoming more prevalent in non-wealthy countries, you're seeing different kinds of questions. For example, are the users always the right people to ask? You can imagine a lot of settings. If I'm building a particular technology, are the users really the ones to ask about their needs? Am I better off asking an expert? Am I better off sort of listening to their needs and ignoring what they say and thinking I know better? Which sometimes is the case. There's actually a maxim, you know, listen to your users and ignore what they say. There is some room in this. I don't really need a new well. I need something else kind of questions. So there's actually sort of, I mentioned this, that there's sort of a evolution in user-centered design as well, thinking about how to do this. And what's still unanswered, I think, is what kind of design strategies might better serve e-government services. Like, we've mentioned some things here, but user-centered design really blossomed, particularly recently, in an era of purely market-driven kinds of things. The government has a different kind of task and a different kind of responsibility. I think it's still open to see what's coming around that. And that's the end of my formal presentation, and there's some questions, so it's perfect.
I have some questions from Digital Land.
Okay.
So I really like the last point you just made about different design strategies for e-government, because I disagree that user-centered design does not care about the exceptions.
Okay.
Because especially if you look at like the healthcare forums or healthcare interfaces, those are very, very important. And a lot of people, like John Carroll, try to make sure you don't fall into error traps. But I think the problem, I think it is a big problem, primarily because it's such a big audience. So one nice example might be the way Google solved it not entirely solved it, but what they do is they roll things out slowly by a small, like, invitation-by-invitation scenario where they still claim it's a beta, but they can get people to use a system, have it grow very slowly so it doesn't kill their servers, but they can find problems along the way. So maybe a guideline for e-government might be like a pilot testing that happens, that grows, you know, slowly and doesn't just open one day where everything collapses. Because I had this experience just the other day with my credit card, because I tried to figure out why it stopped working. I go online and none of the cases applied to me, and there was no other. And I ended up like on the phone for 3 hours getting cut off again and again. But
I think it's valid. And a very interesting point about the rolling out is the way that in the Netherlands, some of these places have solved the problem of exceptions, is that if you fall into these case studies, you can do this online. If not, you need to walk into our office. Yeah. But that's also, it's also a society and a culture and a nation where you walk into your local office. I mean, nobody lives very far from a accessible, yeah, not too long a wait government office. Mm-hmm. Right, and it's a small country, and so it's there are ways around the sort of exception problem, but it's a real issue.
From a cross-cultural perspective, how sensitive is government to the range of cultures and constituencies in terms of exception? I'm not sure what the highest percentage of other than Dutch, so to speak.
You mean within the Netherlands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder about that.
It's tricky. I mean, the most obvious sort of accommodation around that is language, right? So in the Netherlands, you have let's call them white Dutch, and then you have a range of people from former colonies, Surinamese, people from Suriname, people from the Antilles, like I am, from Curacao, and then you have people, Turks and Moroccans are also, and a lot of these populations are first generation already, or second generation, in some cases, third generation. So there's some language accommodation that happens. In terms of design, I assume that's what you mean, like how sensitive are they to need for other things?
Design, yeah. But even in some of the questions that are being elicited, maybe some values inherently are different.
I think like most countries, it definitely reflects whatever the national tenor of what should be happening in laws. So, either you or...
Okay. So I actually have a stack of things coming from the digital world, so
okay.
I feel like I should attack some of them. One of them is around questions of favoring transparency, and Doc in particular is looking at, you know, the UK government policies that are favoring transparency and giving citizens more control over their own data, which has also spurred a different sort of debate in IRC land about you know, to what degree should you be making exceptions and workarounds transparent? How much does this, how much does not doing so privilege those who can do the workarounds? Mm-hmm. What is the role in these issues of transparency?
And it's interesting because part of the Netherlands prides itself in almost all of its arenas on transparency. And it's not a scenario, unlike I would argue in the U.S., where there's hostility towards the government, right? So it's very much a model where, yeah, it's our government, we pay a lot of taxes, and we expect to know what's going on all sorts of levels, and that should be publicly available. So in terms of attitude, there's a high valuing of the transparency. I think what tends to happen is that a lot of the rules and a lot of the reality of getting things done, particularly, for example, around this sort of expat registering problem, is that there are conflicts between different levels of government and different sort of arcane regulations. And so I'm not sure necessarily that the workarounds are, I'm not sure necessarily that the workarounds privilege the elite, because I think immigrants, in particular immigrants who are desperately motivated by a variety of things, can find workarounds just as quickly. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that they're privileging in that way. But I think the real promise in the sort of transparency about the workarounds is identifying the problems and moving from the step of identifying what the problem that the workaround is trying to fix to coming up with a better solution is where it's often a little broken in sort of e-government systems, like thinking about how that, if everyone is having a problem trying to do a particular task, then the government needs to come up with a different way to do it.
Another question coming from digital land is from Wendy. She wants to know how or whether and how privacy is addressed in all of these processes.
I'm assuming Wendy means like in the Netherlands context when you register. Is that your take?
Yeah, I think that's what she's...
Yeah. Privacy is a big deal, obviously. That sounds really stupid. I don't mean it as stupidly as it sounds. But in the Netherlands, people take privacy and privacy of their information very... very seriously. That being said, the higher level of trust of the government means that it's not necessarily politicized in a way that I think in the U.S. it might be. And I'm not sure whether Wendy is U.S. dwelling or U.S.
She's
oriented.
US.
Or So because the rules are often tighter in the Netherlands around, for example, what commercial institutions have access in terms of your data, there's less concern about those kind of privacy in that kind of setting. You can imagine something completely different, for example, in a more repressive government. Completely different. And different kinds of concerns about, you know, the government having the information. But I would say that in at least the EU projects around e-government that I've been involved in, privacy is sort of taken for granted, not very contested, in a way that I think is very, might be hard to believe for people involved in American e-government settings.
I'll just take one more question, then we'll go to this from the internet. This is from John Lee. It's asking, are people's level of comfort with OTC phone mail also a factor for using or not using e-services? As in, like, if it's not broke, don't fix it, kinds of attitudes.
The research that, not from my study, but from out of my university, that Jan van Dijk and Alexander van Dursen have done, has shown that it actually often depends on the complexity of the problem. So the Netherlands, again, is an easy instance, really high penetration of broadband, everyone's happy SMSing, like the DigiID process where you're getting, that verification is done by SMS after you filled in something on the website. So the technology adoption is really high. The type of problem or the type of interaction or the complexity of your problem seems to affect what the e-government people are calling channel choice. Like, basically, do you walk in to your local institution? Do you send an email? Do you send a postal letter? Do you call them up? So it's very dependent on how complex your situation is. But the Netherlands is lucky enough to be working from a really high bar of adoption, so it's not a question of, am I comfortable with SMS?
I was going to ask, I'm not quite sure how to word this, but it seems like what you've looked at really draws out tensions between a commercial world that's, I would say, arguably built into e-government structures because they're built in as a delivery device of information. But I mean, right now, I don't know that we have a way of thinking about this as something other than a product.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of producers, this government that's trying to produce something that's not a product. And I'm just trying to understand if you see resolution through design, if there's that, the fundamental tension is really about we are not selling something when we're increasingly looking and embedding our experiences with these channels as choice, as a deliverable, as, I mean, if that's, mm-hmm. How do folks sort that out, particularly the users, and particularly around privacy? So if they have a trust in the government, do they also trust a commercial entity with their information? And as e-government fuses its practices and it looks more like a commercial choice, isn't that going to threaten their sense of trust with the information? I don't know if I think mm-hmm. I'm saying three things at once.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Sorry.
but we can tackle some of that. I think one of the things is, yes, there's a larger argument that could be made, and I'm not sure how far out I'd be going to make it, about the degree to which the model of the market is dominating the way that people interact with technology, particularly around
much
this.
Much better said than what I asked.
Okay. I assume that's what you mean. Yes, I think the variability of it is to what degree is our particular governments and particular forms of democracies aligned with the market, and in what arenas, we know there's variability, is the market allowed or seen as appropriate in particular arenas of life? I mean, you can think of healthcare as being sort of the obvious example of different countries have different ideas of what role pure market forces should be playing versus government regulation, mm-hmm. right? In terms of the user-centered design and the idea of like designing for something that's not selling, it's not so much the worry that about selling a product as much as I think about relationship design. Mm-hmm. In many countries, particularly in the Netherlands, there is an idea of what the relationship with government is, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily determined entirely by market forces. Mm-hmm. It's not single transaction. There are responsibilities that come outside of the idea of a sort of more limited contract kind of model. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's more of a contract model in a more sort of philosophical, broader enlightenment kind of sense, but not in the sort of I pay you for the service and this is what I get back. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're calling a little bit for an idea of moving away from a market kind of model, it's to think about design that might think of rights and might think of responsibilities and foreshadow those in some of the both the design decisions, but also in understanding users' needs. Mm-hmm. And rather than I need a collection of products in order to live my life. Mm-hmm. But I actually may need government support in order to make a transition. Mm-hmm. That's how I think of it. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yes?
I'm trying to think about what other entities maintain large customer-facing websites with many different activities,
yep.
Especially banks, credit card companies. Are there any, like, are there any that are quite close in their needs to what government needs, and are they farther ahead in solving them?
We had lots of really fun debates about exactly this topic in actually in writing this paper, my colleague and I. You know, one of the ones that I know nothing about them is that I thought of is insurance companies. Mm-hmm. So things like banks, again, they're just they're marketed, you know, they're money in, money out. They actually might be able to detect from your purchasing pattern that you've had a child, but they don't know necessarily the child is sick with this disease, like they don't need the complexity. But insurance companies is, again, not having pursued it, is one analogous entity where they could and do and probably maintain a wide range of information about a wide range of data across a wide range of your life. I'd be interested if there are others or if people think of it that.
Yeah, and I'm also just curious whether they're farther ahead than governments at figuring out how to do it.
Well, they're certainly farther ahead in how to calculate certain kinds of things.
Yes.
But I'm sure lots of people would dispute whether they're further ahead in providing services than governments are. Other questions?
Yeah, I'm curious about the definition of e-government here. This has been a big debate in Australia about how we think about the way in which e-government can operate. And we've been talking very much about the kinds of services you might get from a shop front, you know, getting your work visa, getting your driver's license. But I'm curious if in your research you were talking about people's desire to interact with government at a high level, perhaps about policy, perhaps seeing what's going on at various sort of levels of government information, design, engagement.
Well,
a more sort of e-citizenship model. Did something like this come out in your research, or was it really just focused on the kinds of shopfront services that we've been primarily talking about?
Very little. So Kate's question was based on sort of her work with Australia and sort of e-government. She was wondering in this sort of instance, what I've been talking about are sort of shopfront services, she was calling them, getting your driver's license, getting sort of permits, those kinds of things. But how were people approaching these services for sort of more e-democracy, e-participation kind of interests. And, you know, I, perhaps too cynically, it's not all about participation. Like, people, at least in the Netherlands instance, like, people want their work permit, or they want permission to build the add-on to their house, and to participate in our sort of vision of what democratic debate and participatory activity should be is a little further. There are a couple of interesting articles written about, one about Finland and one about Sweden, about thinking how you can use sort of technology to do sort of government activism. But it's a very tricky scenario in which asking governments to build the tools to allow people to participate or to challenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like, if let's imagine a world in 20 years where almost all of our interactions with the government are electronic. What does protest look like? Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to run and jump up and down on the servers? Like what, we're going to crash the servers by sending them tweets? Like, what does protest, exactly. What does protest look like, an effective protest look like in these kinds of models? And I think it's a little unanswered. I mean, it's weird. You know, there's still, no matter how much we want to let go, there's still a real utopian idea that the technology use is going to promote a more democratic, more participatory environment. And, I mean, I think most people who study the phenomenon say, yeah, sure, on some levels, but that they're, even in engaged political countries like the Netherlands, where people actually vote a lot, there's still a pretty low participatory enthusiasm in the way that we think about it. There's this lovely example that one of the smaller towns in the, that's a little rural part of area of the Netherlands instituted like a chat hour where you could chat with the mayor about stuff. 4 hours on the Koopavond, on like the night where all the stores are open late in the Netherlands, so like it's a good night, well chosen, technology was super easy to use. One person came online to chat with the mayor, right? Not a high demand. I mean, in all, to be fair to the local government, they were like, great, you know, we're creating a way for people to interact. And but the demand to interact wasn't there in the way that I think the sort of hopeful, I mean, hopeful, to, and to be fair, hopeful government people as well hoped that there would be. So I think, you know, there's a lot of debate, even design, about how much room there should be for interactivity on government websites and chat rooms. And we had a whole debate actually in our design about what happens if people are recommending illegal things to each other on the government website, you know, or if they're saying, don't go to this particular outpost because this woman's an idiot, go to this particular outpost. I mean, how do you deal with sort of the review element of it? But there's not a lot of... it's not all Habermas. Sorry.
That's
Sorry.
Gonna be my takeaway.
It's not all Habermas is your takeaway.
No. Can I catch up on that?
Yes.
Just having listened to you, what do you think of somebody like Cory Booker, for example, the mayor of
New Jersey?
New Jersey, North New Jersey, having like more than a million followers on Twitter, tweeting about all different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, I saw him on the Personal Democracy Forum, and I was really impressed because in Germany and Switzerland, wherever in Europe, I can't imagine any politician being able to really make clear why he's doing that, or she's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So is that just fake Habermas?
using now you're asking the really tough question. what do I think about it? Yeah.
Question about if it's administration online or if we are talking about mm-hmm. Online citizenship. Something.
Well, it's interesting. Right. So did people hear that question? Okay. The question was a bit about using Cory Booker as an example of someone who has a lot of followers and has a pretty robust online presence and comparing it to, I think you used the example of Germany and I guess Switzerland, probably in some cases the Netherlands, where the technology use is not of that style. So, for example, there was a really interesting article about Angela Merkel from Germany and whether she should have a Twitter account, mm-hmm. right? And the question was, well, what about, is that sort of a fake Habermas? Is it the fact that Cory Booker has all of these sort of followers and this online presence that gathers enthusiasm? You know, hey, I'm a technologist. I'm the last person to say that the technology is irrelevant. And the fact that people are following Cory Booker doesn't have some sort of transformative, on some level yet to be determined, kind of appeal. But, you know, I'm also cynical in the cross-cultural kind of way where, you know, celebrity is not what we mean by participative democracy. Celebrity is something quite different. And I have a lot of respect for Cory, actually. It's not at all a personal thing with Cory. Whether that translates to a scenario where every politician should be actively marketing their online presence, you know, a la Obama or a la... Cory Booker, and then call that participatory democracy, that's a far stretch in my eyes. You know, not to negate it entirely, but what it means to have real discussion and what it means to have, it all goes back to where you see the engine from having real discussion and real change. Where does that come from? And I think there are people who would argue that the kinds of ideas you could exchange or promote in this sort of online presence might be one, and then I'm a little more old-fashioned and look at things like demographics as like the mover and changer of why societies change, and yeah, I guess it sort of answers it in a cynical kind of way, but did you have a question as well?
Yeah, so
this would be the last question, I should say.
Did you have the last question? That'll be good.
I was curious if in your work or anybody else in user-centered design, if you look also at like call centers and not just online, but also other ways that people get services, both from governments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this one focused just on online, but I know best the Netherlands work, but there's plenty of work on call centers, period, in a for-profit setting, and user-centered design and usability, partly around sort of the language and technical scripting, partly around the sort of cultural, you know, while you're calling a call center in Bangalore and the person is forced to say his name is Paul, kind of, there's some literature around that. But there's also, his name's not Paul. and then there's also a lot of literature and properly done e-government literature that talks about this channel choice. I just skated across this, but the idea that looks a little more at what channels do people use to interact. So for example, in the Netherlands, again, these colleagues I mentioned before did this great study where people at the local offices felt like their phone rang off all the time and that everyone wanted to either call them and hear the answer by voice or walk into their office. So they would tell narratives where, we read this on the website, but I'm calling just to make sure that the website's correct, right? If you ask people's preferences about what they wanted to do in the Netherlands, nobody wanted to go down to the office. I mean, with the exception of some of the elderly or people with really complex situations, everybody just wanted to look it up online. So there is some interesting research that sort of maps explicit preferences of what people say they want, what channel they want to use to interact with our government, the perception of what government thinks how people want to interact with them, and then the sort of, you know, sort of third category of what would be most efficient in a way of matching what the actual need or service requested is and the appropriate channel. Yeah, so there's some work, and I'm happy to provide some references.
So I want to thank everyone for coming out to another wonderful luncheon, and a special thanks to Nalini.
Thank you for having me.